This is Cap Radio special coverage. I'm Randall White. 46-year-old George Floyd was laid to rest today in Houston, 2 weeks after he died while in police custody in Minneapolis. The officers involved in that incident are facing either second-degree murder or aiding and abetting murder charges. Floyd's death has sparked daily protests throughout the nation and around the world. It's also brought the topic of systemic racism into everyday conversations, everywhere from the coffee table all the way up to the U.S. Congress. And of course, social media has been a hotbed of posts ranging from some inspirational, others highly inflammatory. Many people make the point that this conversation is nothing new. It's just coming to the surface right now because of what happened in Minneapolis and several other cities in recent years, including Sacramento. Ed Fletcher is a freelance journalist who worked for the Sacramento Bee for 17 years and knows these conversations well. In fact, Ed says his white friends are contacting him a lot right now, asking about current events and what they can do. Ed, thank you for taking time to speak with us this afternoon. Yet another conversation in your chain.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. I've been excited and energized to help people understand what Black people have been saying for a long time.
Yeah. What's the most common question that you're getting right now from your white friends?
I think the most common thing is them wanting to understand this level of anger and why it went so big and so global. And what it basically says to me is that they weren't paying attention, and that while we were experiencing all of these other incidents, that wasn't in their sphere of vision or never really sunk into them.
And so what do you tell them? You weren't paying attention?
Essentially, I mean, because of the internet now and how we can create our own bubbles, you can effectively live a life of white privilege without having to really think about these police-involved shootings or racism in general. You can happily think that, for the most part, we have overcome those issues because it doesn't impact you.
And over the last couple of weeks, it has impacted these people, and now you're hearing from them.
Yeah, well, suddenly with the pandemic, everybody is paying attention. And we had a case that was just so crystal clear that everybody was astounded that we watched a lynching on the internet. And now they're starting to pay attention and maybe reexamine some of the preconceptions they had before or their blind spots. Mm-hmm. It's a healthy process. I'm glad more people are paying attention than ever.
Now, you grew up in Orangevale, right?
I did. Yeah, I went to Casa Roble High School in Orangevale, class of 1993.
Uh-huh. And so how have you seen the topic of race change in the Sacramento region since you were a kid?
It's hard to really fully understand because I've lived in different worlds. I mean, as a kid growing up in Orangevale, I was one of very few Black people out there. And it was still a little prickly. I mean, little kids knew that they could bring out the N-word and destroy you on the playground. Hmm. So every once in a while you would have an incident, and every once in a while you felt this racial tension in the community, and there were times you felt a little unsafe, but it was nothing compared to living in the South. After high school, I lived in Sweden for a year, and then I went to live in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and attended Southern University, a historically Black college. So pretty much the opposite of where I was before. And through there, I experienced a different type of racism and a little more upfront racism and more systemic racism. I mean, I talk about racist incidents in Orangevale, but by and large, I was loved and had a lot of great friends and got along with most people there. But Louisiana, you just came to this place where, for the most part, black and white people didn't interact with each other too much. And if you, you can always feel the eyeballs on you if you're someplace you weren't expected to be. And there weren't much, there wasn't much integration. And then I moved back to California in 2000, and California had progressed, and it was just striking the difference between Louisiana and California. But while there's been general progress, we've also had this period where we see more and more clearly the injustices done to black people in the hands of law enforcement, and more of these questionable shootings. And as everybody said before, it's not that these incidents are new, it's just that we've got video of them now. And we can see with our own eyes that what the bystanders may have told us in the 80s or in the 90s was true, is true. Now we've got evidence that that has caused the world to stand up and to say enough is enough.
Yeah. Ed, how do you feel the media in the Sacramento area has handled incidents like these, including Stephon Clark recently?
Well, it's been a shift. There's the before video and after video eras. Before video, there would be an officer-involved shooting, and we were almost entirely reliant on the police account of what happened. So you'd talk to the police information officer. You'd hopefully maybe talk to a few neighbors. Hopefully by the end of the day, you got the names of the victims, and you could actually try to call the victims. But in most cases, they're not ready to talk. So you write a story the first day that relies entirely on the police account. And sometimes the families or witnesses will come out and say, hey, that didn't go down that way. But it will often take them weeks or months to get through their grieving and to hire a lawyer and then try to see if they have a case and to complain about it. And by that time, the media has moved on and there's a new earthquake or car crash or carjacking or something else. Mm-hmm. So it's difficult for journalists to dig into these things. And it also becomes an adversarial relationship when you've got to deal with the police information officer every day and suddenly they don't want to give you information or your relationship is strained.
As a freelance journalist now, I assume you feel you have far more freedom to cover the stories that you believe are stories. I don't know what your situation was like at the Bee and whether you had to push to cover issues of race, but now you're pretty much free to do whatever you want.
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, when most journalists at a institution, you've got a lane to be in, and I'll be honest, I didn't necessarily seek out these stories. These stories are difficult to do. But good shoe leather journalism was always, useful, but now cameras have really helped change the game. And, but there's a stark difference between municipalities that are letting that camera footage out and places like Sacramento County that are still fighting to hold back transparency.
Mm-hmm. You've been at some of these events and I think you've even live streamed from them. What's that experience been like? The events, the George Floyd events in recent days?
It's been a mixed bag. I mean, the nights that were turned violent were chaotic and I think unsafe for some of the reporters that were there. I wasn't there throughout that night or as late as some people were. I came back in the day and did a lot of live streaming, but I'd also say that it's been inspiring to see the number of young people and the breadth and depth of the people that have come out for these protests. When the Stephon Clark shootings happened, most times it was almost the same 50 to 200 people, and some days thousands of people, but it wasn't like this. It wasn't such a multicultural outpouring of people who are saying enough is enough. And to see the white people outnumber the black people standing up for Black Lives Matter is inspiring to me. And I think that that's why this may be different than previous efforts.
Yeah, we've spoken with many people, Ed, who say there's an energy right now that should be tapped to make substantive change. Some of the change that's being called for is for the defunding of police departments. We will speak with our next guest a bit about what that terminology might mean, but how do you see it?
I see that defunding the police has been a great sort of slogan and chant and sort of reframing of the debate. For a long time, advocates have been talking about reforming the police, but they never go far enough. I just had a conversation with Robin Ware, who was just the former NAACP president, and he was talking about the report he did that outlined hundreds of cases of alleged police mistreatment. And out of that came the Police Accountability Board. But as he explains it, the city never gave it enough power or authority to really do anything. And they quickly went through a couple people in that office. And now they have no teeth, and we've not seen anything from our accountability boards. So I think from the perspective of Black Lives Matter, like, let's not nibble at the problem. The problem is not a few bad apples or a couple changes here or there. They're saying the problem is systemic and huge, and let's start over.
All right.
And if you start over, then you can reallocate that budget to maybe a third of its mental health and a third of it is homeless and some of its housing. And then you've got a few people that you need with guns and that sort of thing. All there right. may be still need for some guns, but yeah, it's smaller.
Ed Fletcher, longtime Sacramento journalist, thank you for joining us today. And just after the break, we'll speak
Thanks
with one
me.
Of the world's top experts on issues of structural racism and civil rights and the words and phrases we're using right now to discuss these issues. This is Cap Radio Special Coverage. I'm Randall White. This is Cap Radio Special Coverage. I'm Randall White. Professor John A. Powell is an internationally recognized expert in the areas of civil rights, civil liberties, structural racism. He holds the Robert D. Haas Chancellor's Chair in Equity and Inclusion and is a professor of law, African-American studies, and ethnic studies at UC Berkeley. We're very fortunate to have him join us today to help us better communicate and understand each other when discussing the topic of race, which we're all doing a lot more given current events. Professor Powell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Randall.
Maybe we should start with how to set the tone for the conversation. You say it's okay to let people know I'm a little uncomfortable here. I may not know the right words to say.
Yes, I think that shows a level of vulnerability and a level of engagement. And I think one of the things about any of these issues that are complex, but certainly race, is that too often, especially for a community that's suffering a lot, when experts come in and tell them how they're supposed to feel, that's really another slight, another kind of disrespect. So it's important to just sort of say, I don't know what the right word. Is it black? Is it African-American?
What would be the answer there?
Well, I think it depends. Words matter. And there's a former colleague who wrote a book, Metaphors We Live By. We don't live by just analysis. We live by stories, and we have multiple stories, and these stories exist in different contexts. And so part of it is just to engage the people you're talking to. There's no uniformity within the Black community. It actually has different connotations. African-American has a different connotation than Black. I grew up born in a time when I started off as a colored boy. No one says colored anymore. Then there was Negro. So the terms are evolving, and they have political meaning, and they affect different parts of the brain. So I think the main thing is to be respectful and ask people you're engaging with, what do they want to be called? What's the right word? you know.
What do you prefer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, prefer.
Professor, where do you think the biggest hole of ignorance is when it comes to just all of the conversations that are going on throughout the United States on this topic? Where do you see consistently over and over again, people just don't seem to know the history or they don't know the facts. And because of that, you know, they say things that might be off.
Well, a couple of things. We know, and again, another colleague, former colleague at Berkeley, Charles Tilly, he talked about being methodological individualists. What he meant by that is that we don't see structures or systems. We want to reduce everything to the individual level. And by that, we also think of the individual as sort of my experience is legitimate because I have an experience, my opinion. And as a society, we in some sense worship the sort of foundation of the individual. So we don't take the time to really study. Race is actually interesting. I've sometimes compared it to gravity. We all sort of have an idea of how much we weigh. So we think we understand gravity in terms of weight. What they say is gravity is a lot like, the race is a lot like gravity, and that at a really intimate level, there are probably less than 20 people on the planet that really understands gravity. So race is one of those things that's in our face. We have immediate experience. We have immediate opinions, but it's also incredibly complex. And it's not simply about Black people. It's not simply about white people. It's about America. It's about how we organize our society, how we think about things, how we feel about things. And we're part of it. We have a dog in the fight. We have, so it's not like we want to understand Black people. It's really understanding white people. We want to understand anti-Black racism. That's great. But you also have to understand white supremacy. Those things are related. And most of us don't have the time or bandwidth to actually do that. And they all have an emotional charge associated with them. So it's not a simple process. But I think the process we're in right now is a good one because we're starting to talk. We're starting to listen to each other. And it's not just a small group of people. It's people all over the United States and all over the world. But can we have that conversation in a constructive way, or will it disintegrate into just name calling?
And it's okay to admit, I don't fully understand why you would be this angry about something. Help me understand what the history is that, you know, has you marching in the streets for weeks.
That's right. And it's not just, it is the history, but it's also the present. You know, a lot of times they're talking about racial healing, helping Black people heal. But you can't have people heal when you're continuing to actually inflict a wound. So the history is not the history, it's the present. George Floyd is 14 days ago. Amy Cooper is 20 days ago. So it's not really a distant past. The refusal by many Americans to acknowledge that Barack Obama was born in the United States, was a U.S. citizen, that's not a long time ago. That's current. So as some people have said, you know, the past is not the past. Yes, we need to understand our past. And it's interesting. On one hand, we'll say, get over it. Why do you stay in the past? On the other hand, the same people then turn around and say, I got to have my monuments. I got to have my flag. I got to have all this about the past. We're constantly fighting about the past as a way of really talking about the future.
Professor, Professor, I want to talk about a couple of phrases that are getting a lot of attention on social media and other places and have even tripped up some high-profile people, including quarterback Drew Brees, and that's Black Lives Matter versus All Lives Matter. Can you walk us through this?
Sure. So one way of thinking about that, that could be an innocent question, that could be an innocent statement. But when people use a number of analogies. You call the fire department, there's a house burning on the street. And the fire department is not going to say, well, we're going to distribute the water to all the houses. You know, there's something in our laws right now, there's something in our culture that says hate crime is different than just a crime. So if you kill someone or beat someone, because of their race or because of their sexual orientation, because of their identity, is different than beating someone randomly. And what Black people are saying is that, yes, police kill white people too, but no white person that I'm aware of have said they killed a white person because of his or her race. That's different than just killing someone. They kill someone because of their sexual orientation. That's actually, as Ed said, that's an act of terror. That's what a lynching is. It's basically saying every Black person in America should feel unsafe because you are unsafe. White people at the hands of police generally don't feel unsafe. So Black Lives Matter, in some ways, is saying Black Lives Matter too. We already acknowledge and most white people experience a degree of safety with the police. I teach at UC Berkeley, and when I ask my students, if something happened, how many would call the police? Virtually no Black person said they would feel safe calling the police because they don't believe the police would show up with their life and safety as paramount. And so it's saying, yes, Black lives matter too. And it matters with the police. It matters how we allocate money for funding. Think about the coronavirus. People were shocked. It's like, oh, wait a minute. There's a spike in terms of deaths in Detroit and the blackest city in the country. And we can't get protective gear to the Black people, doctors and nurses in Detroit. While 30 miles away in Ann Arbor, which is a primarily white city, you got all the protective gear you need. What's that about? That's structural racism. So that injury of saying Black lives don't matter, we say in our society over and over and over and over again. So it makes sense. It would be like saying, well, the Me Too movement, for men to say, well, what about us? Me Too, why don't you say everybody? Well, yes, men have experience of being a sexual harassment, but it's primarily visited upon women by men. And so it's creating false equivalence. Yes, so saying Black lives matter is not saying blue lives don't matter. It's not saying we don't care about other people. It's saying the country has a particular pernicious function in terms of anti-Black racism that shows up in the police and then protected by the state.
Professor Powell, I want to thank you so much for educating us this afternoon and for all of the work that you do and taking some of your time to be here on CAP Radio today.
Thank you for doing this, Randall, and thank your guest, Ed, as well.
This has been CAP Radio special coverage. Just ahead, cases of COVID-19 are spiking throughout California right now, with many from the Sacramento area being traced back to Memorial Day weekend gatherings. CAP Radio's Nicole Nixon will join us live in about 5 minutes. And tomorrow morning on Insight, Beth Ruyak will dig deeper into the pandemic's resurgence with Dr. Peter Bielenson and others. We'll be back here tomorrow afternoon at 3:30 for more discussions as well. Until then, stay safe and stay well. I'm Randall White.